Welcome to Profiles in Risk, the INS Nerds podcast, the only recurring podcast dedicated to insurance careers, insurtech startups, and insurance current events. We are your hosts, Carly Burnham, Tony Cañas, and Nick Lamparelli. You can find all of our podcasts, show notes, and other great insurance-related content at insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to episode 4 of Profiles in Risk, the INS Nerds podcast. I am your host, Nick Lamparelli, and today with me I have Tony Cañas and Carly Burnham. Tony, Carly, hello.
Hey.
Hey, Nick.
So, I am recording live. Well, it's live for me, but not for the podcast, at the Insurance Technology Association meeting in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and I will be on stage tomorrow as part of a panel talking about innovation and insurance. And what was very interesting today was I just heard a keynote from Tim Attia of Slice Labs, who was very upfront and honest about how difficult it is to do insurtech and how difficult it is to get an insurance company off the ground. And of course, the buzz in the audience was all about Lemonade. And this week, a couple of articles came out regarding artificial intelligence and how they've been able to reduce premiums in renters insurance by 80% because of artificial intelligence, and a lot more buzz that's going on. So I want to kick it to get this podcast started. I want to kick it over to you guys and get your take on what Lemonade is doing, how they're doing it. They're the gift that keeps giving. And honestly, I wrote this in the last blog article that I wrote about peer-to-peer. I have to give them credit. They're willing to, you know, take the hype. They like the hype. They're transparent. And so they're very open to both praise and criticism. So I'm wondering what you guys are thinking about them right now.
Well, I love their marketing, and I still think that the app is really slick. When it hits Georgia, I will be one of the first people to give it a try. I might actually move there. I do think that taking credit for because what one of the articles says is that they can save a lot of people 80 to 90% of what they pay for renters or homeowners insurance, which might be true, but it kind of reminds me of I've always wondered, or at least for the last few years, I've wondered whether it makes sense that people get congratulated for getting married. I think that getting married is easy. Surviving 15 or 20 or 30 years in a happy marriage is the hard part, right? Anybody can get married. It's making it work. In insurance, I think it's the same. Offering a cheap price is easy. Not going down 2-3 years later when the losses come in is the hard part. So it's cool that they're trying a new approach and trying to use artificial intelligence to really lower the cost, but ultimately the losses will tell.
I think it kind of ties back to their belief that they can prevent fraud by having their parts of their profit go back towards a charity of your choice. So I was reading their blog about why they chose to do this, and I was thinking to myself, without people to explain this to the individual consumer, so without an agent or a broker to really explain this concept to each individual person that purchases the policy, how are they going to ensure that the people who are buying these policies buy into that belief? And
I think...
Go ahead, Tony.
Okay, I think their marketing is doing a good job of selling the whole we're a B Corp and excess profits will go to a charity. So I think they're doing a good job on that. What bothers me is that they don't I don't know if they made it, if they make it super clear that they're taking 20% off the top. So they're acting like an agent, more so than like a carrier.
And how do they reinforce that? After you've seen the initial marketing, how do you reinforce your message if that's, you're depending on artificial intelligence?
Well, they're depending on artificial intelligence to underwrite it and to pay claims, but they have the superpower of Dana Ariely, one of my favorite thinkers when it comes to psychology, at least that are still alive. I'm totally geeked out. I've always been an Ariely fan. I'm totally geeked out by the fact that Ariely is now involved in insurance. So I'm very much looking forward to how he will help them navigate the tricky waters of continuing to avoid bad behavior by their members in order to keep the prices low.
So the buzz at the conference was that there's a lot of hype. I think there's a general feeling that what they're bringing to the table is very valuable. There's also a general feeling that it's disingenuous. So the particular article that we'll post on the show notes, the saving of the 80% linked with an AI article did not align because it's not the AI that's saving 80%. They specifically are taking advantage of a minimum premium that exists in renter's insurance. So they explain that for the audience sake, a premium, your premium is built, starts with what the insurance company expects your losses to be, which is called the expected loss. And then there are all different kinds of expenses that are kind of tacked onto that. And what the Lemonade article states is that for renter's insurance, the expected loss is very low. But all the insurance companies writing renter's insurance charge 5 to 10 times that expected loss, and that Lemonade is going to do you a favor and charge you, you know, something much, much less than that.
So what is incorrect?
That could be true, but that has nothing to do with AI. That's just the insurance companies recognizing that renter's insurance is very low premium, and they want a certain minimum premium if they're going to write that business. Lemonade can come in and really take advantage of that. The disingenuousness is that they were trying to like say it was AI that did it. It wasn't AI.
Right, because
because
insurance companies have more costs than a startup, right? We have more expenses. We have buildings. We have legacy systems to maintain. We have people. We have adjusters, we have underwriters, we have sales agents and brokers that Lemonade does not necessarily have. So in addition to the low expected loss, we also have costs that we need to cover, and we need to get a certain return on capital that or premium that we collect.
I think that they're making a fair point. You know, as a consumer, if the expected loss is super low and I'm getting charged 10 times that, I don't care about the fact that you have these nice buildings, right? And the fact that you have those legacy systems that are so expensive to maintain and upgrade. On the other hand, you're Nick's right that it's a bit disingenuous to pretend that AI is making this happen when it's just a different cost structure. And like I said earlier, I'm not convinced that the different cost structure will be sustainable for the long term.
Yeah. And sustainability is important when you're purchasing insurance.
The whole thing really reminds me of conversations that I've had with different venture capital people because of the blog that have approached me. And when I chat with them, their question is always, how do I get to $100 million in a year? And of course, from the perspective of an insurance professional who knows what they're doing, it's very easy. Just sell it cheaper than anybody else, and you know, spend a lot of money marketing, and you'll bring in the business. The problem is you'll crash and burn, once the losses do come in.
One of the things I've been thinking about when it comes to Lemonade that's similar to some conversations we've had about other insurtech firms is it important to them to be long-term sustainable? Or are the innovations that they're bringing to the market, such as the app and their claims handling process, such that they see a future in selling those processes and then exiting the market?
I think that we should start an office pool as to which carrier is going to end up buying them. Because I've never worked in that world. Let that be a disclaimer. I lived in San Francisco for a bit, but I never worked in that world. But it does seem, from the people that I know that work in startups, it does seem that their main reason for existing is to sell themselves to Google or to another large incumbent in whatever business they're trying to disrupt, with few exceptions, like let's say Uber, who was not trying to sell themselves, or at least thus far hasn't.
And certainly I hope I'm wrong, because I think that what they're saying is interesting to me. I think it's interesting to a lot of people who are like me, and I'd like to see them succeed and be sustainable, but certainly it's just something to think about and watch over time.
Even more than that, like it'd be great if Lemonade makes it. I might end up being one of their customers. What I would love to see is for Lemonade to shake the industry and to start seeing more and more of interfaces like theirs. And I would love to see. I've been wanting to write this article for years, and unfortunately, I haven't done the research yet. But I would love to see more carriers go the B Corp route. Mm-hmm. I think that would be fantastic, and I think it's very compatible with the historical idea of mutual insurance that attracted me into the industry and that keeps me here. I would also love to see more carriers adopt the transparency stuff or the ideals of transparency and let's have open numbers and because Ines Gertz is our history is career focused. I would love to say. I'd love to see carriers take that approach to internal salaries, for example. I think that there's a lot to learn from what Lemonade is trying to do. I don't know if they're doing it in a sustainable way at this point.
Yeah, I think there are fans. There's definitely a lot of praise, but there's an element, just enough of an element of disingenuousness where it seems as though they're preparing for an exit. There seems mm-hmm. as though they're preparing the company to exit out. And I hope they succeed too. I can't wait till they get to New Hampshire. So I'd like to try it out.
Well, they said 50 states this year.
Okay. So, but that gets me to my next point, which is you brought up the B Corp. I have no internal conflict with the B Corp. I have an internal conflict with the B Corp and the charity. I don't think they go well together, and I'm going to explain why. B Corp is essentially a nonprofit. So when you're in PNC, I can't wrap my mind around any kind of concept where there's leftover money. To me, in PNC, there's really no such thing as leftover money. I know there is, but especially now that they're expanding, they're going to be going to cat-prone areas. So I just don't think the charity is sustainable. I just don't think it will pay. I know I just in one of the articles that we'll post, he mentions again that it's their full intention to pay the charity every single year. But think about it. If there's leftover money every single year, that means they're charging too much. They could pull that back and charge even less because they're a nonprofit. So
if we looked at the surplus at the capital surplus of a company like State Farm, we've talked about them before offline. They're sitting on what, like $70 billion of surplus, something like that, like an incredible amount of money, even by venture capital standards. So I think that if Lemonade stayed in short tail lines, so yeah, if they go into workers' compensation or like big liability lines that can take decades to get fully settled, then yeah, I would agree with you that that giving money away to charity would be very hard to do because there's no extra money in the long term. But if you stay in short tail lines like renters, I think that there's an argument to be made that.
Okay, that's fair. That's definitely fair. It's just that from a VC perspective, because we've now have two articles online that deal with how an investor is thinking through this. If someone comes up to me and is trying to tell me that renter's insurance is the next Uber, I'll kick them out of my office. That's not. It's just not big. It's just not big. Not big enough a market. That's where I'm getting to with this. You know, there's this like almost zeal like atmosphere of we need an Uber in insurance, and I just don't see it. Like especially this with all the hype, I think it will succeed, but you can't. To get to $1 billion selling renter's insurance, you're going to have to own the entire market. And I just don't see that happen.
What about renters and homeowners?
Still no? I think they're going to struggle on the homeowner side. It's already super competitive. And I think that's an area where, especially when they expand, they're going to have huge exposures. They're going to have to charge the right price. The added expense that traditional insurance companies have, they do have that, but they also have cheaper capital. You mentioned State Farm's $80 billion in surplus. State Farm can write business at a loss, but they can still make money for the year because of that surplus and the investment income it's throwing off. And they're a mutual. At the end of the day, that's good enough, you know? How does a lemonade compete with that? Yeah, they don't have the buildings or the people. They have the better technology. But State Farm's sitting on $80 billion of surplus, so they can just keep writing at a loss. Lemonade's not going to be able to do that. So
I have for years wondered whether publicly traded and much less venture capital backed, but even publicly traded, I wondered if publicly traded companies make sense in the insurance, in the property and casualty insurance market. I know there's many of them, but it does seem that it creates a conflict of interest, right? And Nationwide has talked about it in some of their commercials during the Join the Nation campaign, where we're a mutual. There's no conflict of interest with our investors. So I think a conflict of interest is hard to square sometimes. And when it comes to venture capital backed stuff, that conflict of interest is severe because they need a strong return since they're taking a huge risk. That's but true. I think I'm probably getting too far away from the core topic.
Carly, before we switch topics, any parting thoughts on Lemonade? I'm sure this is going to be the pinata. That's going to come up time and again. I think they enjoy it. We're doing the marketing for them. Tony, you love their marketing. We are the marketing for them.
I was at a conference earlier this week as well, and in many of the sessions, they were referred to as the company that we will not name. Yeah, I think we'll come back to it over and over again, but it's an interesting time to be watching this develop.
I can tell
it's an amazing time to be in insurance.
It is. I can tell you from being at this conference, there's so many interesting things going on. How this shapes out. I have a particular vision of how I think it's going to shape out, but it is moving fast and furious. And Tim Attia asked the question at the keynote speech he just gave. Do you think there's a lot of hype in InsurTech? And more than half the hands in the room went up. So there's a feeling, you know, you can call it a bubble, you can call it whatever you want. It'll be interesting, and I'm sure we will be talking about Lemonade and a lot of the stuff, in future podcasts. So
I want to be careful in the industry. I want to make sure that we don't sound arrogant. I want to make sure that we don't get arrogant. I do think that with 500 plus and growing insured companies coming after us, somebody is going to get it right. Now we have big moats around us with those big capital surpluses that a lot of the carriers have, but I do think that the industry is going to be shaken by all this innovation that's coming after us.
Shaken, that's a good word.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think, and we're ripe for shake up, and it's a good time for that to happen.
Yeah, and I for the audience that's listening, if this is a particular career choice you might be looking into, you're going to want to listen to future podcasts, because we have a lineup of guests that are going to hopefully have some good information, but also where we can have some structured debate around where this industry is going and what the field is going to look like. So now I'm going to transition over, and this is going to be very touchy. I'm going to see how well I can do this. Trying to be non-political, but this past week had a lot of articles around the repeal of the ACA and some kind of replacement. So Trump Care, Trump Care, Obamacare, I really don't care. All I know is my frustration is that we as a country don't actually know what insurance is. And it was difficult to listen to people yell at each other back and forth across political lines talking about what they thought insurance was, and most of them getting it wrong. So I'm going to throw this back out to you, and we'll try to make this non-political. We'll see where this goes. But to me, insurance is about risk. And so insurance is not just like a pool of money, right? There's the pool has to be nicely segmented. To me, insurance is, if you're going to put people into the pool, they have to contribute to the pool in direct proportion to the risk that they're bringing to the pool. That's very important. And then there's some uncertainty about, well, we don't actually know the precise risk. I'm okay with that. But to me, insurance, it's very important to be able to put a dollar tag on risk, because ultimately what we're trying to do is we're trying to reduce the risk. So if there's no dollar tag, then it's going to be very difficult for us to figure out how to get that number down. So it's very important. So with this whole health insurance thing, the average 20-year-old should have a lower premium than the average 50-year-old, because they're bringing lower risk to the pool. And I heard too many times that no, it's a pool. The lower risk should help pay for the higher risk, and I don't disagree with that. It's really a question of proportion. The pool is not just some homogenous pile of money. There has to be some semblance of order. That's my frustration. So I'm going to throw it over to you. Let's see how non-political we can make this.
So I think first I would say none of us have ever worked in health insurance, right? So we want to throw that out there, that while we may have gotten producer's license in selling health insurance and life insurance at some time in our past, none of us have ever worked in health insurance, right? Am I
correct?
Right? Okay. I don't know.
I have memory on my life and health license.
Oh, that was my life and health license.
Oh, so we both had life.
Yeah.
Yes, I have never worked in health insurance, but I do know that 20-year-olds on average are less risky than the average 50-year-old. I know that.
I need to see your actuarial tables on that, Lamparelli.
So I think one of the things that I think about when this debate comes up is health care and health insurance are two different things. And we, as a nation, have a tendency to think of them as one, which I think is sort of what you're getting at, Nick. The agency I worked at sold very little health insurance because it's not a great value proposition to an agent or to a company necessarily. Because health insurance has begun to encompass routine care. And that is not necessarily risky. You know that you're going to be paying out certain costs every year for your insurance. In theory, those costs should go to make your pool less risky if you have preventative care every year. However, I've never seen data that indicates that preventative care actually improves your risk of health issues in the future. So I have a lot of thoughts on the subject. A lot of them are informed by an author, Sarah Cliff, who writes for Vox.com. A lot of them are informed by being close to the medical field in my personal life.
What do you mean by close to the medical field?
My husband's an emergency room resident. All of his family have been in healthcare practice in the past, so they have feelings about health insurance that are related to being healthcare practitioners as opposed to being understanding of insurance.
So hold on. I'm gonna have to pause you here for just a second. It's been fun to have you in this insurance career. Are you about to drop out to be a doctor's wife? Once he is fully active as a doctor?
I would be bored out of my mind. Absolutely not.
Good. We would miss you a lot. Sorry for interrupting. I just had to give you a little crap there.
No, I think I was done. I think there's a strong frustration on my part that people don't understand insurance. The secondary frustration is that health insurance and health care are not the same, and we should not talk about them as though they are, and we do, over and over.
Okay, so I should give my own disclaimers. I've never worked in health insurance, like you mentioned. Insurance is insurance, and I know enough about health and about life insurance to be dangerous. I also grew up in a country with socialized healthcare in Costa Rica, and I come from a family of doctors. In fact, I am I'm the black sheep of the family. I'm the only one that didn't go into the medical field. So I'm pretty familiar with it, and I agree with a lot of your frustrations. What really gets me is the fact that none of the proposals. Obamacare didn't do it, or the ACA didn't do it. Trump Care or Ryan Care, whatever you want to call this one, or I think they're calling it like the world's greatest healthcare law, at least in the House of Representatives. Anyway, none of them are dealing or have dealt with the costs in the system. So as long as we continue to be the country that has the highest costs in the system, we spend more money. Both in total nominal number of dollars and as a percentage of GDP than any other country in the world, and yet we are like number 17 in outcomes. Don't quote me on that exact number, but we're not in the top 10 in outcomes. Well, we're definitely number one in expenditure. So really, the conversation should start at how do we lower the costs in the system? And then we can worry about, okay, now how do we ensure those costs? But if we don't lower the costs, it becomes really, 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 really hard to ensure those costs. And the other thing I wanted to address Nick's point of 20-year-olds should be charged less. Yes, actuarially they should be, and that's where there is a question of morals and a question of the ethos of the country. Basically, as a country, we have to make the decision. Of okay, older people and people with chronic health issues like diabetes or whatever other chronic health issues will be much more expensive to treat over their lifetimes. As a society, we should decide whether and to what extent we want to subsidize their care out of a matter of human decency, and that's more moral than an insurance question, basically.
So the cost perspective is interesting because we don't really talk about that in property and casualty insurance, right?
We complain about it.
Right. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about, especially on the liability side, you'll talk about the cost to settle lawsuits going up. But on the property side, it feels like the market pretty well regulates the cost to repair a home or repair a building. On the healthcare side, or health insurance, from either perspective, those costs are less concrete because you have research costs that are going on. You have, we've talked about this before, Tony. You don't. It can't operate as a free market because I can't, when I'm in the hospital, being treated for a stroke or whatever it might be, say to my doctor, are you the best value? Maybe I should go down the street to Dr. B and choose him because he's a better value. I need the care now. I don't have a choice. So regulating costs in that type of market is challenging. And how do you think about that from an insurance perspective? Is that our responsibility or is that regulation?
So the reason I bring up cost in Costa Rica, where I grew up, we have the socialized healthcare system. And to be honest, I grew up not being a big fan of it. And then I came here and I spent 14 years here, and I've never really been sick, not significantly sick, but my few interactions with the system have been such that I ended up going like, okay, so the socialized system in Costa Rica is not fantastic, but it sure beats the worry of ending up bankrupt if I get cancer or have an accident. Because we have the public system in Costa Rica, which is not perfect, but it's good, because we have it, we also have a private system, and most doctors work in both sides. My mom and most of my family included have both private practices, and they work for the government hospital. What happens is the private side, the prices are kept in check because of the existence of the public system. So basically, you don't really need health insurance in Costa Rica because you're covered under the public system, and the private system is priced in such a way that a professional with a decent salary is able to pay out of pocket for most things, which is not the case here at all. And I think that the reason the price is reasonable is because it's kept in check by the free public system.
So
okay,
I think my final opinion on that is that if we're going to, insurance is directly related to cost. So that's how the that's how the premium should be developed. So in PNC, we take care of certain things. We know there are limits of liability, and that's a very tough question. I bet the healthcare outcomes, it's a Pareto distribution. I bet 80% of the costs come from 20% of the people, and I bet
most end of life and chronic diseases. Yes.
So, do we, in PNC, we would have a limit of liability. Is that reasonable? So that's the first thing. The second thing is that if a 20-year-old is forced to pay something equivalent to what a 50, 60, or 70-year-old is paying, just from my experience in insurance and human behavior, I don't think that's going to work. I just think in the long run, that 20-year-old is going to say, that's not fair. Just like, why should my home in New Hampshire, why should my homeowner's insurance policy be the same as someone that lives in Miami, Florida? Or why should my auto insurance be the same as someone who's a 17-year-old driver? So if there's a huge disconnect between risk and premium, there's going to be a revolt around that. And you see it with the ACA as well. There's not enough young people coming into the system, even with mandatory coverage.
So to be clear, or I guess not to be clear, in my opinion, I don't know that it's related to that. I think that actually ties back to cost, right? If I'm a 20-year-old, I might not know how much my 6-year-old, 7-year-old grandma is paying, but I know that that bill that comes in every month, I can't pay that. Yeah. It doesn't matter to me if it's 3 times, which I believe is what the limit in the ACA is, or 5 times, which I believe is the new proposed limit.
3 times or 5 times what?
5 times. So there's
the older person.
Yeah, the older person would have 3 times that of a healthy younger person.
With the ACA.
Versus 5 times with the new bill, right? Because the new bill actually proposes increasing costs to older people. And spreading that gap a little more. So I think the new bill does attempt to take more of a risk-focused approach. However, it doesn't matter because no one can afford the premiums. So if you can't afford the premiums, then you're not going to buy the health insurance.
So then that circles back to the actual healthcare outcome and the cost it takes to get there. And so we will just keep spinning in circles. And at some point, we need to get off the merry-go-round, you know. And you know, part of it, I think, is just, you know, just politics, the way politics is. But I think most people agree that it's a big enough problem. I just wish we had the right people that, we could debate this thing. We could debate the morals of this without drawing these, you know, hard lines in the sand. It's very sad.
I wish we had some chance to educate people on insurance fundamentals and healthcare fundamentals. I agree.
Yeah. Well, one thing that we've just kind of brushed over that's been hugely politicized over the last 8 years is the whole individual mandate. And I do think that as insurance professionals debating this or talking about this, I think it's important for us to point out from the insurance perspective, outside of politics, from the insurance perspective, the individual mandate is absolutely, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's absolutely necessary. If we take away the ability to discriminate on pre-existing conditions, and if we take away the lifetime caps, both of which things I personally think are necessary for a properly working health system, but those things mandate that we have the individual mandate.
Otherwise, and you see individual mandates outside of health insurance. Most states require you to carry auto insurance. Most states require you... Well, yeah, you don't have risk if you're not driving. Most states require you to have workers' compensation.
Only so if you hire people.
Tony.
If you have risk, you're required to have insurance, right?
Correct. But
the point with the mandate is... the whole health insurance infrastructure collapses if you can't get low risk.
Right.
If you for an insurance pool to function well, you can't have all high severity individuals in there. It won't work. It'll be completely unaffordable. So I completely understand the mandate. It makes sense. It's for a free market capitalist like me, it's tough to swallow, but I completely understand it.
It's un-American.
If you're going to go in that direction, though, and you're going to have a public healthcare system, then the low risk people have to participate. It's the only way it's going to work.
But Nick, the founders in the Constitution, wiseness, I don't think that's the word. In older wisdom, thank you. Sometimes my English fails me. It's my second language. In older wisdom, did not say that the government should be involved in healthcare. But we're going off the rock.
Leave it to Tony to bring the politics.
I love being the devil's advocate.
Okay, so let's bring this up again as the bill is kind of working its way. Maybe we can be the rational voice of insurance.
I want to make a quick prediction. This is going to be our first podcast or article that we ever get a hate letter because of.
Maybe we'll
just
get
remember all political opinions were expressed by Tony Canyas. Nick and I were totally neutral.
Listen, I did my best to stick with the insurance stuff.
If someone's going to boycott us, please put it on Twitter, insnerds.com. Give us, just spell it right. That's all I ask. Okay.
Spell it right. That's a good one, yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to transition over to one our final topic. Since I am at the Insurance Technology Association meeting, I am bumping into all kinds of technologists and startup founders and investors, and the world is changing. And a topic that came up, and I think I will be sitting on a panel tomorrow on innovation, and we went through a dry run, and the topic of Tesla, which article came out this past week. Tesla feels that their cars are so safe and Tesla is so innovative that they threw out I don't know if it was a proposal, I don't know where this will go, that they may embed the insurance in the car. And, you know, I've been following autonomous vehicles. You guys have blogged about that kind of thing in the past. And this seems different, though. For one thing, this is, first it's Elon Musk who gets things done, but this is the kind of business model I've been predicting, which is insurance will be abstracted from the user. I could foresee in 10 years where individuals don't buy insurance, or they buy insurance and a product comes with it, or they buy a product like a Tesla and insurance comes with it. So I'm going to throw this back out to you guys. What do you think of this? What do you think of this as a potential business model? And what do you think this would do to the industry, and specifically for our listeners, folks that deal with auto insurance?
Well, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, a little bit about Lemonade, or excuse me, they're stuck in my mind now, about Tesla proposing this. And even at the conference that I was at Monday and Tuesday, there was some conversation around, a lot of conversation around the talent crisis, and following that, conversation around auto premium dropping. So I think as we watch the career space, we'll see jobs develop that we hadn't thought of before, and positions will continue to increase in risk management and commercial underwriting, commercial claims. However, personal lines auto is going to be an interesting space to watch as these vehicles come out and potentially embed their own insurance.
The transition will be slow, will be 15, 20 years, because it takes a while to replace the fleet. If I worked for a carrier that was mostly or entirely focused on auto, especially personal lines auto, I'd be worried, definitely worried, at least in the long term. Career-wise, which is kind of my favorite part of our discussions and of our blog, career-wise, I always advise people to start making their way towards commercial lines, because that side will take longer, hopefully much, much longer, to get automated away, because it's more of an art than it is a easily brought down to a science, easily made into an algorithm. I'm sure we'll see big changes. The way I imagine it, I think that I sold classic car insurance for a while with American Modern sales manager, and people who drive classic cars need a different type of insurance than people who drive normal cars, and they drive classic cars because they want to. They spend a lot of money to drive classic cars. They could have a new car. They decide not to. I think we'll see that for a long time. We'll see, even as the fleet, let's say 30 years from now, most of the fleet becomes self-driven, I think that people will continue to drive because they like to drive, and they'll continue to buy classic vehicles because they like to drive. So there will always be work, and there will always be premium on that side. It'll just be much, much smaller than it is today.
I think two other points on that. While some of those insurance jobs in the personal auto space may move out of traditional carriers, as these companies develop their plan, that knowledge of personal auto insurance will be useful to those companies. So people with a strong understanding of those actuarial concepts and insurance concepts will be useful. It may just be at a different place than you had expected. So I would watch that. The second point that I thought of when Tony was speaking was at the same conference that I mentioned a couple times, there was a lot of discussion around the fact that the industry is ripe for disruption and things are changing. But there was a general feeling that we are actually trying to be proactive. And we're talking about these newcomers, I guess, who are looking to shake things up. And we're trying to think of how to manage that risk, whether it's diversifying our services, diversifying our products, or just thinking about risk and insurance in a new way. So we say it all the time, it's an exciting time to be here, and it really does seem like it's permeating many different levels of the companies we work for.
The industry, you hit it on the dot, that the industry has woken up, and that compared to when we used to go to the big conferences, let's say 3 years ago, and nobody was talking about insurtech. They were talking about replacing their legacy systems, but they were not talking about anybody outside the industry. And now it's almost all they talk about is what's going on in the insurtech space. And a lot of the carriers have opened their own incubators or their own VC arms. So I think we're in the game now, which makes me feel much better.
Yeah, I think for anyone that's working in auto insurance now, my gut feeling tells me that Tesla will not be backing the insurance. They will probably be using a traditional carrier to embed the policy. So if you're in the technical details of underwriting and actuarial and claims, I think that will probably remain the same, just different companies and in different style. From the production standpoint, though, if you're producing auto insurance business, yeah, watch out. If something like this takes hold, this is completely different. This is one transaction to one company, and then it's transactional within that company. No more need for the local agent to sell auto insurance. That could be the death knell of auto insurance being sold in this particular way. So. I'm sure we will talk about this quite a bit, but we're running short on time. And so I think going forward, I think we'd like to end this in a personal way, end these podcasts, and we'll go around the horn, and I'll start with Carly. Carly, this past week, what was something that you've done that you're proud of or happy to have accomplished?
Well, this week we had an event at my company called Generation Connection, and the purpose of it was to get together with people from other generations and discuss what you see for the industry going forward. For instance, how to attract people in the industry, whether they're millennials or those with experiences that would be useful to our company or others in the industry. So I spent about an hour and a half on Thursday meeting with some people and discussing this, and it was a really valuable conversation, and I am glad to have been a part of putting that event together.
That's great.
Tony?
I gave my session on millennials at the Risk Trends 2017 conference at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, this past Tuesday, and you guys know it's like my favorite thing in the world is giving that session a couple times a year. And the reason I mentioned this time is because something that had never happened before happened, and I woke up the next morning to find that the local Richmond newspaper ran an article on the conference, which was 80% about my session, and they had two really good pictures, one of which is really funny on the article, and they got really interesting as I got added on LinkedIn by about 50 different people. INS Nerds got a lot of views that day, and we got a lot of people joining our newsletter, and it was just a great day. So you know, always love doing that one, and having it get noticed by the media was a lot of fun for somebody with my personality who loves the spotlight.
Can we get some of the pictures on the show notes?
Definitely.
Okay.
Good. Absolutely.
Okay. So this past week, I changed my LinkedIn status to put blogger and podcaster at insnerds.com, which I am very proud of. And so I will be the chief enthusiast and really try to spread the word. So I'm very proud of that. And hopefully soon I'll be able to announce something that's about to happen. So there's with all this insurtech stuff going on, there's a possibility that I might be participating in that in a way. So I'll be able to announce that at some point, hopefully very soon. So that's the thing that I'm most proud of. So there you go. So that's going to be a wrap for this particular episode, episode 4. Don't forget to like us on or review us on iTunes. What do we have to do, Tony, on iTunes? Do they have to
rate us or five leave stars. A comment on iTunes. Leave us a 5 stars on iTunes. At this point, we don't even show up unless you search for our name. Like, if you search for insurance, we don't show up yet. So we need some reviews so that we can start showing up.
Okay, so please give us a review. Please give us feedback. What would you like to hear? What would you like us to talk about? If you're listening and you would like and you think you have a unique perspective, drop us a note. Maybe we'll ask you on and have you participate as well. So that's the end of episode 4. Rate us, review us, and until next week, we will talk to you later. Bye, Tony. Bye, Carly.
Bye, Nick. Thank you.